The greatest pay I can ever get is that smile on some child's face, or the one that runs up and hugs your leg,
yeah,
or grabs you around the neck when you're sitting there, or something like that. And they just look in your eyes, and you know when you look into their eyes that there's an unconditional love there.
Yeah.
And those kids, you know, they make doing anything as far as being a clown or an entertainer 100%. That's, you know, that I'll sign my check over any day.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Following a recent magic auction here in Houston, I took aside two of the top kid show entertainers to talk about their careers and advice on working with children, scripting, getting into school and library shows, and more. We even get into talking about how to find work with corporate conglomerates like McDonald's. They also talk about their best and worst performing experiences. Julian Franklin was a teacher turned full-time professional kid show entertainer. For many years, he wrote a column, The Business of Magic, for The Linking Ring, and has authored Kid Control, a popular book for children entertainers. He regularly performs in libraries and school shows across Texas, and has appeared as a lecturer and performer at Kidabra, a magic convention for children entertainers. David Hinken worked for McDonald's for 37 years and has a ton of experience entertaining for children at nearly every venue you can possibly imagine. These days, in his post-McDonald years, he still specializes in entertaining children. So, if you ever work for children, either exclusively or for family shows or, well, ever, then you should listen to this podcast. I think every magician will get something out of this episode of The Magic Word. This is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me today Mr. David Hinken. Hey, David.
Hi there, Scott.
So you know what his voice sounds like. And over here is Mr. Julian Franklin. Hey, Julian.
Hey, how's everybody going out there?
And so we were just talking about children's magic shows. You were starting to ask him a question, what, Dave?
I was asking him, you know, basically what themes he covers for his school shows.
And so the answer is that I have, we have 12 different shows. Our company does 12 different shows. We're in the process of writing a 13th show. So normally what I do is I write a show for the summer for the public libraries to do their summer reading theme, and then try and tie in some educational concept with that, so that then in the fall I have had all summer to polish it and refine it, and bring it into the schools where I sell it to the schools, and it's got already got the educational component in there, and it's already a working show. And so then I'll add that to our catalog of shows, I guess. So we've been doing it for 13 years, and so this will be our 13th show that we've had. And there's a lot of performers in the market that write a show, and this is the only year that you can get it. This is we've released it. This is it. At the end of the year, I'm retiring it, never to do it again. Limited time offer, and I think that's a nice marketing position to take, is this, if you don't get it this year, you can't have it. But I went a different route where, you know, I went through all the trouble of writing that show. I don't want to get rid of it yet. And so so I have the show still in my offerings, and so I just put it in a box, and it's in...
It goes in rotation or something? I think Doug Shear does something kind of like that, doesn't he?
Yeah, see, I believe that Doug also has several different shows that he offers, and so he's got a patriotic show that I think is very popular, you know, on Columbus Day and President's Day and different things like that. And then if they're having a theme, you know, if their theme is our school has been around for 50 years, or we're celebrating our centennial, this school's 100 years old, that's a perfect opportunity to tie in that show with that school's theme, even if it's not everybody else's theme. And so that's why I keep it. A lot of times they'll have a theme of, you know, here in Texas, where they'll do like, we're doing our reading roundup. Well, look, I've got a Texas history show, the Wild West Reading Show, and so it's a great tie-in to what you're talking about. And so I've got a show about Texas history. I've got a show about world geography that's a secret agent theme. I've got a show about diversity and bullying that's an artist sort of theme called Color Your World. I've got a show about the scientific process and life science called Go Wild. I've got a show about physical science called It's a Simple Machines, Lever, Pulley, Wheel, and Axle, that is called Work Smarter. So anyway, 12 different shows that we've got, some a couple of math shows and some stuff just for high school and higher, a probability show that we do for fifth grade and up.
And some of these shows really do not include a lot of magic, but more science and reading and
yeah, absolutely.
Math
and, yep. Yeah, no, that's a good point. For example, one of my most popular shows is a show called the Simple Machines, the Work Smarter, Not Harder, which I've developed that show in conjunction with Tommy Johns out of Atlanta, Georgia. He actually had the show idea originally, and we were working together on another project, and he mentioned it to me as if he said, "Oh, I'm so glad I met you. Now I don't have to do this crummy show that I used to do." And he started describing it. I said, "That sounds like a great show." He said, no, it's not that good." I said, "Oh, yes, it is." And so I said, "Give it to me. Let me work on it, and I'll show it to you again and see if you like it." And so we worked on it together, and I built it up. And then he did get to come out and see me do the show. And he was like, "Oh, yeah, that's a great show, man. I love it." So, that show's actually endorsed by the National Science Center out of Augusta, Georgia. And so it's a really neat program for me to do. It's one of my most popular shows, and it only has one magic trick. I'll go through the whole show before we do
an hour, 45 minutes.
Right. I've actually done that show. Sometimes they say, "How long can you keep the kids engaged?" And I'm like, "Oh my goodness, you're talking to a magician." You know, my old joke is, if you need to fill an hour, hand a microphone to a magician and tell him to do 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so I've actually, with that show, I love it so much. I say I can really do an hour and a half of these, because it's science experiments. So, I mean, where we're lifting huge buckets of 50 pounds of rocks, and I can have a little kid lift it with their pinky finger, and they're bending pennies with their bare hands, and really through the power of a lever, and what the different things we can do with a pulley. And so we're measuring these things so that we can actually see that, wow, it really does make a difference. And so, normally my shows are about 45 to 55 minutes, but that show I can run 90 minutes without any trouble at all. And then at the end we do one magic trick, which is a forced card revelation. So I think a lot of times magicians see my show and they say, you're not even a magician, you know, and I use a lot of puppets too. And so puppeteers see my show and see my lips move and say, you're not even a very good puppeteer. Said, nope, not again, not really.
Well, do you mainly do it around Texas, or are you doing it around the country, or just regional, or what? Other states nearby?
Yeah, no, I only work in Texas. I've had people call me from, I've done two shows in Louisiana, because where I live in Texas is only about an hour from the Louisiana border. And so I've done two shows in Louisiana, but after that I stopped marketing anywhere outside of Texas. I had a lady from Chicago who found me on the internet and ironically enough wanted my Texas history show, and she was willing to pay travel and everything if I would just come up to Chicago and do the show. But so much of my business is repeats and referrals that I thought, I'm going to be opening a can of worms. If I go up to Chicago, then next year they're going to want 2 weeks and not sound arrogant, but if I can work at the level that I want to work and sleep in my own bed at night, why would I want to do the same thing
right
in Chicago away from my family for 2 or 3 weeks at a time? And so,
and how many shows you do a year?
Not as many in the last couple of years as it has been in the past, but, at its peak, I had two guys working for me. I had to hire other performers to actually do all of the work that I was doing. But because we were averaging about seven school days per week.
Among the three of you.
Right. Yeah, obviously I'm not, school's not open 7 days a week. He's lying! But when we were doing that, now, even before I hired the guys, I was working about four and a half days a week. Now it's down to maybe about 3.5 days a week, maybe
yeah,
3 days a week. And that's an average, because, you know, there'll be May, for example. I know every year in May, every single day of the week, I'm booked in May.
Is that because they have a lot of money that's left over towards the end of the school year?
Yep, that's it. And they want to reward the kid. The state testing is over, you know, in Texas. And I think now in a lot of other states, they have this state mandated testing. And in Texas, it's been happening for many, many years. And they really test this last two or three years, they've changed the test to what we now call the STAR test. But that's been, I think, part of the reason that we're not booked as much as we used to be, because they're so nervous about this new test.
Trying to keep them focused on...
I don't know. I mean, it's so strange, Scott. They're doing so many weird things as far as, like, where they have a practice test, and then they do the benchmark test. Because anytime you have a new test, you don't really know if it's... if the test is accurate or not, you know. So you have to test the test, if you will, you know, to see, okay, if this kid scored this score on the old test and he scores this score on the new test, then those two scores should be about equal, assuming that the child is about equal. And so you have to kind of test the test. And so the whole first year they were testing the test. Well, to do that, let's do some benchmark testing, and let's do some, you know, because obviously the kid that took this test last year is not really the same kid. He's a year older, he's got new issues, you know. So there's a whole lot of problems that they deal with. So anyway, they're doing benchmarks, they're doing practice benchmarks, they're doing the test, they're doing practice tests, they're doing, I mean, it's just crazy. I think last year, out of 183 school days, I think we counted that there was like 60-something days where they were testing in the schools. Wow. That's a crazy amount of official testing, because obviously those days, they're not having anybody come in to do assembly programs on those days. Nobody's coming in. And so, that's affected our business a little bit over the last 3 years. But still, I look at it as an opportunity, because then we say, okay, now what we need to do is write a show. Like, we've got a show that I just did on Friday. That's a game show. It's a game show format with zero magic tricks. You're talking about there are no magic tricks. I just set up a game show, and we ask some silly questions and some academic questions, and then when we're done, we tie that into the difference between answering questions in the game show format and when you're answering them on the test. That when you're in the game show, for example, you have to be the first one to buzz in, which is not true on your test. Take your time. Right. There's some things that are tricky. Anyway, so it's test-taking strategies that we go over. And so we try to use it to our advantage as we develop these new shows. But
I was going to ask David also, because you used to work for the McDonald's Corporation for a number of years. It had a little different color paint on your face, I think, during those years.
Well, I did the booking for McDonald's for all their school shows. And we had, through the years, we probably had 12, 15 school shows that we did. Everything from ecology to bullying to character counts, reading. We had probably three different reading shows and different things like that. And I found through the years that we a lot of places, as Julian mentioned, they offer just one school show. I found out here in Houston, in the market, since I only book for Houston, that they were interested in three things. They were interested in reading, they were interested in character building, and they were interested bullying.
Anti-bullying,
Anti-bullying, and it's just one of those things. And they developed a new show just as I was leaving the program for, actually our character covered the first four pillars of character building, which was fairness, trustworthiness, respect, and responsibility. And then there were two pillars, which was caring and citizenship, that we developed another show for, which was kind of nice. And it kind of just, if they had one year, then the next year we're trying to come back and do the other two pillars. And
when you say that you developed the show, that's something that's developed by the McDonald's Corporation that they do nationwide, or something that you scripted and wrote yourself, or
well,
how does that develop?
Well, a lot of the shows that we got are canned shows.
Canned meaning?
Meaning that
they came from the corporation.
Came from the corporation, but a lot of us had input into what was going on with it. They worked with national groups like the Character Counts Council. They worked with the National Library Association. They worked with Dr. Eblow, or I think his name is, on several other children's shows.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of backing behind it. But once we got it in the field and stuff like this, in Houston here, one of the things is they want a 35 to 40-minute show. They want it to fit the period, okay? So consequently, we either had to, most of the shows we got were 55 minutes long, so we had to narrow it down. But the thing was, and the thing was that was most important is you don't lose the message of the show.
Right.
Because every message had like 4 or 5 points. So you kept those 4 or 5 points going and do them through the show. So we had to trim down here, there, and everything like that.
But and you had to have a certain time also that you would give. I mean, you were given 45 minutes, kind of like what Julian was saying?
Yeah, we were given that amount of time, ancillary time for the teachers.
Okay.
But that's how it worked, and it was pretty good. And it's just, it's amazing, you know, to have something like that. So, you know, working on it on my own, I've developed two shows for schools coming up here. And, you know, I'm marketing them out to in the next probably two to three weeks.
So now that you're not doing anything then officially with the corporation, then that's something that that you have developed and carried on then yourself that you can do individually?
Yeah, I've written my own shows and stuff like this and kept the theme work, because the theme is the most important thing, whether or not it's developed by McDonald's or whether it's developed by, you know, any other corporation or things like that. The character counts. Character counts, they want, you know, those actual pillars to be sold each and every time you go out there.
Do you think that's the most difficult thing, Julian and David, ask you both, as far as the scripting? I mean, the concept of the schools come to you and say, here's what our themes are going to be this year, and then you work from that? Or do you go to them with an idea? And what is the most difficult part of the job, would you say?
Well, for me, it's just like back when I was booking, we offered four shows. We offered a standard magic show, we offered a reading show, we offered the character count show, and we offered the follow-up show for the character counts. Mm-hmm. And we went ahead and used those four, because if you get too much going, I mean, you're packing and unpacking right and left and everything. Now our shows fit in the back of a van, and it was like, you know, you had to have three men and a horse to get them unpacked and packed back up. And if you had to do that...
So that's the most difficult part, is the packing and unpacking.
Yeah. And then forgetting stuff, you know, once you get there. So,
Julian?
No, I've always said that we don't get paid to perform. We get paid to load our shows and drive to the shows and unload the shows and set the stage and strike the stage and load it back up and drive back home. That's what we get paid to do. The performing is
the fun part.
That's
the real business.
That's the only fun part is where we actually get to do our work. But no, the hardest part for me is to write a new show. So what we do is have a... and there's two different sides of it. One is the educational component, and then the other one is the theme. So the theme, I usually try and tag along with whatever the library is doing for that summer. But then the educational component is, you know, I talk to teachers and principals and school counselors and PTA parents and find out what it is that they really want and need.
But is that the National Library Association or something like that says, here's our theme for this year?
And they right. Yes. So in Texas, we used to have our own up until just 2 years ago, and then and they stopped doing it. But we used to have our own separate from everybody else. And now there's like there's still a few states that are holding out and do their own sort of thing. But for the most part, there's about 46 states that all collaborate and do it as a group, and Texas has finally joined them. And so now we have the same theme as basically almost everybody else in the union.
I wanted to ask something kind of about beginnings for both of you guys, because you're both doing school things and doing things for youth. That is, one, I want to talk to you, David, about getting into McDonald's. How do you get into doing things with that organization? And I want to talk with then you also, kind of how that you'd come from your background and getting into doing school shows and doing this on a full-time basis, and how you became published author then as well. So let's talk first then with David. You know, if you're wanting to work for a corporation like McDonald's in particular, who offers entertainment for youth, do you just go to the local McDonald's down at the corner, or do you contact the guy in Chicago, or what do you do?
Definitely not to go to the local guy in the corner.
Okay.
I mean, mine was dumb luck. I knew Ray Kroc's stepdaughter. So
that helps, yeah. Founder of McDonald's.
That helped very much.
Those of you don't know who Ray Kroc was, founder of McDonald's. Yeah.
But, you know, through the years, things like this, they right now run what they call secret auditions.
Okay.
So basically they're looking for people that are very talented and things like this. A lot of their people are right now coming from Ringling Brothers, Retired Clown, and different things like that. But, you know, they're still looking for independence and things like that, as far as people that do have talents and multi-talents.
So McDonald's actually goes out looking for clowns rather than, I mean, kind of soliciting people they might like?
They're looking for entertainers.
Okay.
Because that's the thing, one of the things is, when you have Ringling Brothers clowns, they are basically stretched out as being clowns.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you have to understand, as far as when you go into this, it's great to be a juggler, and it's great to be able to do mime and everything like this, but when you go into a school or use some sort of theme, you become a teacher. And when you become a teacher, you have to know magic, you have to know all the different things.
Psychology and working with children.
Exactly.
Different ages have...
And this is something that Rowing doesn't teach.
Yeah.
I mean, they do teach it to a certain extent, to what to do if you walk up on a kid and he's petrified, how to get out of it and all that stuff. But, you know, through the years, it's really an ongoing process. I mean... I always say, and I use the words of Ray Kroc, when you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you're rot. So I'm always learning. I mean, here I am, 65 years old, and I still learn stuff. And when I stop learning, that's when I'm going to stop performing.
Yeah. And you had worked with McDonald's for 17 years or so?
37 years.
37. I was off by 20.
Yeah.
And so that was something that you had worked on the East Coast and then came to Houston and worked in the Texas area for a long time.
But it's always been a learning process. I've studied with some of the greats. I've studied with some of the great clowns like Earl Cheney.
Because you didn't start off as a clown. You started off doing what?
I started off just doing magic.
Okay.
And I was doing magic and trade show magic, birthday parties, everything like that I could get my hands on. And back
then, kind of fell into the
clown. And it was like Linda Smith, who was Ray Kroc's stepdaughter, her and I were in a community theater in the town I lived in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And her and I had done a couple of shows together. And I went to a dinner party seeing them off because he had just gotten to be general manager of the San Diego Padres from Kroc Bottom, her husband. And so consequently, I just turned around and I said, well, when the guy on TV dies, drops dead, or you just don't want him anymore, call me. I'll fly out to San Diego and I'll do those commercials for you.
Yeah.
About 3 weeks later, I got a call from the advertising agency and said, well, I hear you want to do this.
Wow.
And I said, yeah. And I said... And believe me, it wasn't a bed of roses, the first appearance I did. So I just, you know, at that point I said, this ain't worth it.
Yeah.
But then I got the mindset of knowing that, you know, what could it be?
And there's training, I guess, and everything.
And that's it. That's it. You know, it's partly educating the people you work with, and as well as educating the people that you are entertaining.
Yeah.
So...
And so you enjoy that. So again, you're doing school shows and birthday parties and everything now. And you've always been a children's entertainer, I guess.
Yeah.
Been your focus. I say always in trade shows early on.
Yeah, I'll do anything.
Yeah.
Hire me.
I think as most magicians would, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, in that case.
So
what has been your best and worst experiences?
Well, I think the first experience I had was one of the... shows that I did, one of the first shows I had done, an owner-operator inadvertently took a bunch of Frisbees and threw them out right after my show. And unfortunately, the stuff that was between the Frisbees and
the
audience was my magic equipment.
Ah.
And it went right up over, and he says, don't worry about that stuff. I said, well, you haven't paid for it, so, you know.
Yeah.
But basically, that's the thing. And as far as, you know, the greatest pay I can ever get is that smile on some child's face or the one that runs up and hugs your leg or grabs you around the neck when you're sitting there or something like that. And they just look in your eyes, and you know when you look into their eyes that there's an unconditional love there.
Yeah.
And those kids, you know, they make doing anything as far as being a clown or an entertainer 100%. That's, you know, that I'll sign my check over any day.
That's great. And then asking you then, Julian, as well, is about getting started with what you did before you got into magic. Were you a teacher?
That's correct, yeah.
And so you'd work with children.
Right.
And so it seemed like
actually, even before I became a school teacher, straight out of college, I opened a karate school. So I was always sort of education with children. And so I had a karate school for several years and then started doing substitute teaching because obviously when the kids are in school, they're not in karate class. And so I had my days off. And so I would do substitute teaching. And then I became a full-time teacher. And it worked really well with the kind of overlapped. And then I wound up getting into magic on the weekends birthday parties, and then found out about the summer library programs, and I thought, what a perfect tie-in, because I've got my summers off anyway as a school teacher, and so I'll write a show. But the teacher in me said, I want to make it educational, and so this is comes back to an earlier question that we were talking about. And so I had the theme was Read Across Texas. This was when Texas was had its own theme, obviously, and then and that was in 2002. And so I wrote a show. I said, I'm going to make it a little bit about Texas history. Kids are going to learn something about Texas history. And so I wrote that show in 2000. Actually, I wrote it in 2001, and then sold it in 2002, and it did really well. And that's how I got my foot in the door. Parents would bring their kids in to see the show. Teachers are also parents frequently. Mm-hmm. And so they would bring their children into the summer reading program. And so then they would say, we got to have this in our schools. And so that's how it kind of took off.
And when before we started recording this podcast, you had said something about that if you are a published author, that you are more well-known and have a better opportunity to get booked or get a better performing fee?
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, if you've ever, when you look at what the types of performers that people bring into schools, I mean, the fact that I wrote a column for the Linking Ring for 8.5 years is, it's nice for me to say I'm a published author, but obviously the school children don't know who I am. They don't read the Linking Ring. You know, I have a book, Kid Control. I've got, you know, several different other books, but none of those are books that the kids have read. And so, right. You know, frequently they'll come in, they'll say, what books have you written? And I always tell them, none that you've ever read. It's all boring stuff for grown-ups, for magicians and stuff. And I like magic. I don't know, all right. So, but that's my whole thing too, is I say, even if I had an award-winning book, I don't think that I would want to go to a school and necessarily be about, I want you to read my book. I just want kids to read. I tell them all the time, look, if you want to read magic books, that's great. You know, I'll tell you where they are in the library. I said, but you might like books about animals. You might like books about creepy animals like snakes and scorpions and spiders, or you might like books about beautiful animals like horses or, mm-hmm. or butterflies, or you might like books about animals that almost nobody else knows about, you know, deep sea creatures, and or maybe even animals that we're not even sure if they exist, like Bigfoot and ghosts, and whatever it is that you love, though, we've got books about that in the library. And so that's the tack that I take, is that I don't care what books they're reading, I just want them reading.
You gave a mini lecture to our group one time before and saying that it was not so important when you go in to talk to kids about reading, because they're there at the library already to read. So you don't tell them you need to read or recommend this book or go to this Dewey Decimal area or whatever. You want to address that? You want to talk about that? You know what I'm talking about? You remember?
Get more specific, okay. If you can, because there's a lot.
Sure. I remember there was something I thought that you had said once, that when you're at a reading program, someone said, well, do you encourage the kids to read? You said, no, they're already readers. You're not there to teach them to read, because they're there because they like books to begin with. So you're trying to teach them something that might expand their mind into...
Okay, so I'll agree with that to a certain extent, in the sense that I want to... a lot of times when the kids are readers, they're reading in a specific subject area. And so one of the things that we want to try to get kids to do is to broaden their horizons as far as what they're reading. In other words, it's very important when kids are learning how to write, for example, and writing comes from reading. Good writers were always good readers first. And so there's lots of different ways that people write. There's persuasive writing, for example. These are things that kids have to learn in elementary school. They have to learn the difference between persuasive writing, informative writing, and entertainment writing. And so there's three different broad styles of writing, and of course, obviously, hundreds and hundreds of sub-styles. I mean, when you get into entertainment writing, for example, there's you know, historical fiction and science fiction, and the list is endless. And so so what we want to do is they have to understand those three broad categories and all these sub-genres of literature. And so it's very important for them to read those various types of writing. In order to be good at writing them, they have to have read them and experienced persuasive writing and informative, informational writing and entertainment writing and poetry, all these different genres. And so, one of the things that I try to do is to say, look, if this is what you love, yes, of course read that. Of course read that. But you might want to also try this. If you like Spider-Man comic books, that's great. You might want to also actually read about real spiders. I never thought about that. I might, I like like this entertainment aspect of Spider-Man, but yeah, you're right. I might really like the real science behind spiders.
How did it become Spider-Man?
Right, right, exactly.
The nuclear reactor. Not about nuclear fission or something.
But to a kid, yes, that's a real motivation. Yes, yeah. If I'm ever going to be Spider-Man, I need to learn more about real spiders. Yeah. To a kid, that is a very legitimate motivation.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I have no problem with that. Tying in to look, if this is your love, then by all means, explore every facet of it. And so I want them to I do think that, if you're a person who goes out to eat a lot, nobody has to come up and say, hey, Scott, why don't you go out to eat this weekend? But they might definitely come up to you and say, hey, Scott, you really ought to try this restaurant. I don't know if you're into Italian food. I don't know if you're into Thai food, but there's this really neat place that we ate at da-da-da-da-da. And so and 9 times out of 10, all it takes is a recommendation like that. Right. You go, you know what? I will try it. And so that's one of the aspects that I want to do. So I want to move everybody one or two steps up on the ladder of where they are as readers. So if they're not really motivated readers, I want to inspire them to realize how fun reading can be. Mm-hmm. If they like reading, but they only like this, to Junie B. Jones, that's all I ever read, then I want to try and get them up. If they only read picture books, I want to get them into chapter books. If they only read the simple chapter books, I want to bump them up. If they only read this, then I want to get them also into nonfiction. If they only need to read nonfiction, I want to get them to read some fiction. So yeah, that's my goal, is to one step at a time, move everybody a little bit further along, wherever they are, move them one step up, or two steps, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, is there any advice you would give to anyone who is wanting to advance into either one of your careers of what you guys have done and working like with children?
I would say get as much time working with kids as you can. In the sense that, you know, I think being even if you just go get a job as a substitute teacher, just being in the classroom, I think the biggest hurdle to being a successful school show performer is being a really good performer, as bad as that sounds, because you're used to everybody constantly clapping, you're used to that everything is really fast-paced and not one dead moment, whereas when you're teaching children...
You have to love kids, too.
There's no doubt. Yes, for sure. Yeah, I mean, if you don't enjoy kids, don't even get into it. Yeah, but yeah, I think that if you... that there's a certain sense of having a group of kids in front of you and talking about Texas history, talking about doing what's called a book talk, for example. And if you're not sure what that is and you want to get into schools or libraries, Google book talks and just see how people do like basically a 30-second commercial for a book or a type of book. Mm-hmm. And because that's part of what you're doing. You're a motivational speaker for kids when you're a school show presenter. So it's not just about having the kids clap for you. It's not just about standing ovation at the end of the show. It's about that the kids are engaged with what you're saying. They're listening to what you're saying. They're remembering what you're saying. They're applying what you're saying. I always tell people, you know, at the end of my show, if they say, "Oh man, the kids really loved that show," to me, that's not really a very high compliment, because I would think that that's like your baseline, that the kids enjoy the show. I say the real test is, do they come in later on and ask for the books that we talked about? Do the kids come in and score higher on their reading tests after, you know, in 2 months? Do the kids come in does the circulation at your library increase after I leave because you're checking out more books? The kids are reading more voraciously than they did before. That's the real test. But it's not as difficult to just entertain a group of kids as it is to educate,
inspire,
and entertain and inspire all at the same time. Yeah, you definitely have to be a motivational speaker.
Advice over there for
my advice is to polish your show. When you think you have it, practice, 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 and then when you think you have it, still practice.
Where? In front of the mirror, before a live audience? Where do you find those live audiences?
Practice in front of your relatives. They know you aren't magic. Mm-hmm.
They'll be your harshest critics, too.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And, you know, the thing is when you're talking to students, the one thing that I've learned through the years is you don't talk down to them.
Oh, that's a good point.
And you want to talk to them on their level.
You know, physically, I've even heard that before, and Julian, you may have been the one to tell me this, and that is that when you're talking with youth, particularly one-on-one, that you don't physically look down at them. You kind of kneel down so you're looking eye to eye to them also, I think.
Yeah, it's real important to let them know that you aren't talking to them in the sense that you're actually making fun of them.
Sure.
And, I mean, you can still have a good time, pull a joke on them, things like that, but don't take it to that level where you're going to embarrass a child.
Yeah, never embarrass
them. Never embarrass them. And the thing is I've seen so many magicians that have gone out for a children's show and things like that where they go through the motions, they do the thing, the kids turn around, they pack up, they leave, they get their check and go. That's the type of magician that's not going to be remembered. When you end up going to a school or something like that, and you have the guidance counselor, or the librarian, or the PTO president come up to you and say, "Oh, that was really a fun show. It was really great. We really got educated on that." And even though it's a message that they've just been banging home in the classrooms right and left, I always say the best show that you have is you teach some students without letting them know that they're learning.
But on the other hand, when you talk about, you know, not embarrassing children, when you're doing something like the 20th century bra or underwear or something like that, that kids giggle and they laugh. You're not embarrassing them. Do you agree or disagree?
I would totally disagree with that. I would never do that trick. Okay. I would never do that trick.
Some do, some don't. Yeah. I mean, I don't do children's shows, so I'm just asking you.
Yeah, no, I don't do that trick.
Because it would be embarrassing, you think?
Look, and I know there's going to be people who are going to get really mad at me, but look, if you're making your living in schools, you don't need to be doing underwear or dirty diapers. You don't need to be doing fart jokes.
You don't need to do booger jokes or any of that?
I don't. And I'm not saying that kids don't think it's
funny.
What's
the title of one of your books? I thought you had a book that was called Eat My Boogers or something.
No. It shows a picture of a kid picking his nose. Kid Control. Yeah. Kid Control. It shows kids picking their nose. But no, I don't. And I don't use fire. I don't use blades. I don't use, you know, when we were talking about the dove pan earlier, and you were talking about the fire, somebody came up and, you know, when I said, "Oh, yeah, you do that trick in one of my shows," and they said, "How do you do the fire?" I said, "I don't do the fire. And there's never any fire in any of my shows. There's never any swords in any of my shows." And the reason is I just take an ultra conservative viewpoint. I mean, this is what I think. Yeah. I mean, look, this is the thing. If anybody can, it's that low hanging fruit. Anybody can make a joke about a fart. Anybody can do slapstick. I've never found slapstick funny, and I know there's a lot of people who really do. But I thought, look, real humor, and it's definitely harder. But if you're really funny, you can make people laugh without anybody being the butt of any kind of joke. You don't have to do the, "Oh, give me your hand." "Oh, no, I meant the clean." "Oh, that was your clean." You never have to do any of that. I don't care if you say, "Oh, kids get it, they get it." I totally know that. I know kids get it. I don't believe this, if you do that, a kid will try and light a book on fire if they see you doing the fire book that they'll try. I do not believe that. But I do believe that there are parents who believe that, and if I do it, I'm going to have to answer to them.
They're the ones paying.
Exactly. And so why even get into that argument with somebody?
Bill Cosby on Johnny Carson's show. Here's how long ago that was. And he was being interviewed and asked about that same thing about baggy pants comics, you know, back in the vaudeville days or whatever. And they were called baggy pants because, you know, they would drop their pants to get a laugh. You'd laugh at their funny-looking underwear or something.
Right.
And he said, the problem is that once that you have dropped your underwear, you can't do it a second time.
Right.
You know, your pants are down. It's like, okay, there's a laugh. What else you got? You know, and so you have to be above that and have more eyebrow humor. I mean, you know,
right.
Instead of that kind of thing.
Right, right. I think the closest that I ever get to anybody being the butt of a joke is when I'm engaged with puppets, and they'll sometimes make fun of me in a way that I then quickly, it's almost more that it gives the kids an opportunity to show this is how you could interact if somebody was mistreating you, that you can blow off a joke. In other words, I do when I'm doing the magic drawing board, as I'm erasing him, I say, you know, he says something like, "Oh my gosh, I feel like I'm getting lighter." I say, "Yeah, you feel like you're getting lighter because I'm erasing you." And by that time I've erased his ears, and then he can't hear me, and then I have to draw his ears back on. I'm erasing you. "So you look like right now I'm erasing all your hair." He screams.
Yeah.
I said, "Gosh, what's so bad about me erasing your hair? Now I look like you." And then I turn to the audience, I grab my head, because I'm totally bald headed, of course, and I, you know, grope at my head like, "Oh my," and then I look surprised, like, "I can't believe you insulted me," you know, and then I just put a smile on my face, like, "Oh, you got me good," you know, whatever. Yeah. And the kids laugh, but it's at my expense, not the kids. It's not even at the puppet's expense, so I'm never a mean person. The puppet is kind of, you know, we have that a little bit of an adversarial relationship, I think, is good with puppets. It's acceptable with puppets, but I don't want that to ever exist between me and students, or definitely not between me and a teacher. I know a lot of people think it's very funny to embarrass the teachers. I think that's even worse than embarrassing
like
the kids.
The principal or somebody.
I think it's even worse than embarrassing the kids. It undermines the principal's authority. It undermines the teacher's authority. And some principals can take it and laugh, and some principals will spread the word. And that's
never
the whole.
Back.
Yep. And the thing about school show markets, it's a great market because they really have no problem sharing good performers with others. You know, in the business world, if you had a great trade show performer, that business would want to keep it a secret. But in the school show market, that's not true. They do share. The bad news is, if you're a bad performer, they will share that also. And so it only takes, you know, upsetting one person, one parent, one crazy parent who saw that you had fire in the flash pan and get upset about it to ruin a career. And so that's why I just be, I'm just ultra, ultra conservative. And yeah, it makes it harder for me to write my shows. That's why I said the hardest part for me is writing a show, because I have to write it with humor that adults laugh at. I have to write it with humor that kids laugh at. And I have to do it without referencing bodily functions. I have to do it it just has to be organic humor that preferably even then ties into some educational concept. So yeah, it's not easy, but that's what
I'm sure with the corporate market that you couldn't do that either. But now
we have a rule. We had a rule all during the thing. If it poops, if it flames, or it's dangerous, sword through neck or anything like this, it's taboo. Mm-hmm. It's not being able to use. And they use the analogy, not that it would ever happen, is, you know, do sword through neck, turn around and get up the next morning and find newspaper where little Johnny decided to do sword through neck on his sister Susie because he saw the clown do it at the school. And, you know, the chances of that happen are like 99,000 to 1. But well, do you want to be that responsible for the one? Mm-hmm. And that was the whole thing. And, you know, because I know there was, when I started in this business with McDonald's, I had trained a couple guys, and a guy had the most beautiful sword through neck. It was just so funny. And it was really great, and the whole thing about it is I looked at it and I said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. Well, I was not his friend for about 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we became the best of friends. But he understood what I was saying, and it's just like one of those things. You just, it's a fine line to run sometimes, but, you know, it's because, you know, you've got a good routine with something or something like that. Or it's nothing. I mean, I have personal issues. Back then, if you're wearing a clown wig and you spray it down with hairspray and you'd use a flaming book, you know, you never know what's going to happen because that hairspray is so flammable and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just, and if you're doing, you know, live animals or something, nothing worse than having your dove come out and go on the floor. Of course, the kids love that, but, you know.
You got to clean it up or it's not going to be good.
Or do the Johnny Thompson deal.
Yeah. Well, just kind of start to wrap up over here, and I appreciate your time from both of you. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast, so I'm going to ask each of you kind of what is it that's important to you that would be a word, not necessarily something that you may or may not use in the context of your show. It could be a phrase. It could be a sentence. It could be, again, a motto, something that you live by. What is important to you? What is it that makes you want to get up in the morning, your life goal, what gives your life meaning? Julian?
Oh, well, yeah, I was going to say, that's a pretty deep question. I thought we were just going to talk about
magic.
School show performing. Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I've got a family. I think this is what I tell people from time to time. I love what I do so much that I hope that I'm able to do this every single day until the day I die. But I also want to make sure that I do not have to do this every single day until the day I die. So part of what I do, you know, we were talking earlier about the value of you know, when the kids, you know, hug you and the smile. I mean, even without, you know, just from the front row, just seeing their smile and it's so rewarding.
Their innocence,
But I do appreciate what magic has provided for me and my family. I do appreciate that I've made my living doing this for so long, and I'm glad that I've been able to make the sort of financial progress that ensures that hopefully I can continue to do this for as long as I want. But at the same time, I don't want to ever have to wake up and do a show because I've got to pay for my wife's medicine or, you know, whatever, something like that. And so, I guess that's it, that I'm going to keep moving forward doing what I love. And hopefully continue to make money doing it. So that,
doing what you love and loving what you're doing.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. David, you had a chance to think about it.
I can, you know, agree exactly with him, but it beats the alternative of what you have of not getting up.
That's right.
And, you know, the whole thing for me is, you know, to be able to go and do something useful and being able to go out there and have a good time doing it. Mm-hmm. My football coach in high school turned around and senile old coot turned around and was the meanest guy in the world. He says, but you say, he would always say, you know, when you find a job you love, you stop working. And yeah. I stopped working 50 years ago. And I wouldn't give it up for the world. I mean, there have been setbacks and things like that. And I thought, you know, I wanted to get out of it when I left McDonald's and things. But it's one of those things, I just can't give it up.
Yeah.
And my wife says, sit back, retire. And I'm going, nah.
Yeah, as long as you have breath
yes.
to live. All right, well, thank you, David Hinken, and also Julian Franklin. I appreciate both of your time for being on The Magic Word. And I appreciate all the advice and everything that you gave everybody then, too. I think that the rest of the listeners will enjoy this. So, for The Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.
Thanks again to Julian Franklin and David Hinken for your time, knowledge, and voices on this podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions on this podcast or questions for either of these gentlemen, then please leave your post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. I appreciate your support, and thanks for listening to The Magic Word. So until next time, this is Scotty out.